The Mech Geek Gab, episode 585 for 27 December, 2015.
Welcome to the Mac Observer's Mac Geek Gab, the show where you send in all the stuff you want to tell us about or ask us about, and we answer it like car talk for Apple geeks, except we're told we're a little more polite. Sponsors for this episode include iMazing at iMazing.com, where coupon code MGG saves you 20%. We'll tell you more about that later. And Squarespace at Squarespace.com, where coupon code MGG saves you 10%. Here in Durham, New Hampshire, I'm Dave Hamilton.
And here in rainy Fairfield, Connecticut, John F. Braun.
And here in drizzly Durham, New Hampshire, is Pilot Pete. Thanks for having me, guys.
Thanks for coming back, Pete. Yeah, it's always good to have you.
I got to apologize. If you want to go back and re-record the intro, my dyslexia was acting up and I got the number backwards. I said 585 instead of
585. Yeah, that's right. Another palindromic episode, folks. That's right. MGM 585. Wait, no, GMG. 585. Oh, whatever it is.
Oi.
How was your Christmas, John?
No, it was good. Hung out with friends and family.
Cool.
You know, good food. Put a bunch of pictures on the Instagrams you may have seen.
Cool. Yeah.
And Santa got me everything I asked for.
Well, that's because you were a good boy this year.
And I put it on my gift list. One fun thing that I got, so it led to a little adventure, but I got so one thing I asked for was a hard drive to upgrade one of my NAS devices here.
Uh-huh.
Because as you probably know, but if you don't, so the Synology that I have, which is the DS713 Plus, has two bays, and for a while I've been running it in non-optimal mode because Synology's hybrid RAID is how I have it set up, so it's basically, you know, redundant. But
yeah.
For the longest time the drives were of different sizes, so what happens then is that it only uses as much space as the smallest drive in the array. So
because you only have two drives.
Correct.
If you had multiple drives in a Synology unit, more than two is multiple, but if you had three or more, it can use the storage space a little more efficiently than it can with just two, and sometimes can make use of all of it even when the drives are different sizes. But with just two, it's effectively a mirror. That's right.
Yeah. So I pulled the smaller drive. You know, I checked the documentation to make sure you can do hot swap, which almost most NAS devices should allow you to do that. Which means that you can pull a drive or put in a drive while the thing is on. I guess in the old days, maybe you couldn't do that. But so, you know, I pulled the old drive, put in the new one.
Yep.
It complained. It started beeping and yelling at me and sending me notifications saying something was up. And, yeah.
Danger.
And then it basically repairs it. And then once it, so technically you actually go through a repair operation, and then I got more space. But then I was like, oh, what do I do with the, so I put in a 3 and then I pulled a 2.5, drive out, and then I'm like, well, what do I do with this? Well, let me put it in the Drobo.
Oh, there you go.
So I inventoried what I had in the Drobo, and you'd be shocked, Dave. So I was like, well, you know, I should probably pull the oldest, smallest drive out of there.
Is it like a 320 or something?
No. Well, here's what I had in there. So I inventoried the drives here. So one thing that's annoying is, so most manufacturers put the date on there in a format that people can read, except Seagate. These guys. There's a tool you can look online.
Right.
You look up the Seagate date code, because it had some code on it and it wasn't, you know, didn't list like the month and the year. But the oldest drive that I had in my Drobo, Dave, and so I pulled that and I'll probably put it in an enclosure, was a Hitachi Travel Star 1 gig drive.
1 gig or 1 tera?
1 terabyte.
I'm sorry, 1 terabyte.
Okay.
And the date on it was May 2007.
Wow.
I bet you paid some coin for that.
No. So I had two Travel Stars, and I think they were eventually. So it was Hitachi, and then I think IBM acquired them. But So I actually had two of those drives in here. One was dated May 2007 and the other was dated December 2007. And actually, I was like, wow, where did I get this drive? Well, I know where I got it because it had a teeny little Apple on it. It was actually the drive, I believe it came with my G5 tower. And that's still cranking. So I got two drives in my Drobo right now that are dated, or now one that's dated 2007.
Yeah.
So those travel stars, good drives.
Cool, man.
Seven. I mean, it's 8 years old.
So now you added 500 gigs to your Synology storage.
Yes, sir.
That's cool.
Yeah. Cause I'm packing videos on there, you know, and using DS video. So I was running low in space there.
So. Oh, that's right. So you run DS video with your Apple TV or your computer if you want too. Mm-hmm. But yeah, cool. So, you know, we have been using, we had been using DS video for a long time. Obviously with our third gen Apple TV. And then when we got the fourth gen and apps started coming out for it, we were really, really happy because we could finally use Plex on the Apple TV, which means we can navigate right on the TV. We don't have to navigate from our phones. We went to watch a movie last night though. And you know what? It's still way easier to just use the phone to navigate and say, play this movie on the TV. And with the way Synology's DS video works, you're not airplaying it via your phone. Your phone is simply acting as the remote control. It's still airplaying directly from the disk station or whatever, you know, whatever device it is. But with DS video, it's from the disk station directly to the Apple TV, no quality loss or anything. And it's just so much easier to do searches and stuff on the phone.
Oh yeah.
I suppose it'll get easier when you can do, when like apps get, the ability to tap into the Apple TV's universal search. Then you can just from the main menu, you can say, I want to watch, you know, whatever movie it is. And then boom, it's going to find it and you select it and go. But you know, the phones are pretty darn handy for that kind of, it seems like we don't need to reinvent this wheel.
Yes.
Yeah. All right. Should we get to it, John? Should we start answering some questions? We're going to do some cool stuff found later in the show today. But right now we've got a couple of good questions from you folks. So let's get there and we'll start with Johnny. Here's Johnny. He says, I turned to your extreme. I have thank you, Johnny, for your compliments. I have an early 2008 Mac Pro running 10.9.5. I haven't upgraded as I have an old version of Photoshop that I need to keep alive as long as possible. I am always terrified that upgrading will break something and that I have a lot of downtime fixing the problem. Anyway, recently the inkjet driver started crashing repeatedly and he sent us a log. Says I didn't get a lot out of the log other than that the fact that the driver crashed. Even if the driver does not crash, only the first page will print out before it hangs. Printing works okay for one page documents, but sometimes I need to print two pages. I can print to the printer from my laptop without problem, so I think the printer is okay. It's an HP 2510, or at least that's what he said in his email. Other things I've tried, and he said he rebooted. He ran Onyx to clean out as many caches as it could find. He repaired permissions with Disk Utility. He deleted and reinstalled the printer a couple of times. He says, in the old days, I would just reinstall the driver, but in this 21st century world, that seems no longer possible. Maybe I'm stuck doing an over-the-top reinstall of 10.9. So I looked at Johnny's crash logs, John, and I saw it tells you it, when you look in the crash logs, and these really are helpful. I know it's crazy that we say we ask for these things, but it's fun and it makes it helpful, and hopefully we can teach you something. So in the crash log, it's going to list which thread crashed. And as John has astutely pointed out in previous episodes, each thread is kind of its own little box inside the bigger box of the process. And so looking at that, the thread that was crashing was labeled status reporting. So we can thank the HP developers for being a little bit verbose in what they're doing. So this is this thread that's reporting status back. And I started thinking, well, now this makes sense. It crashes after one page because after one page, it's going to send the status back and say, I finished a page. And then that's it. The driver's done and it doesn't have anything else to do. My question then to Johnny was, where did you get this driver? Is it the driver that's coming with OS X, which is normal? OS X includes a lot of drivers for a lot of manufacturers. And the manufacturers provide these to Apple, but they don't necessarily keep them up to date. And when you plug in the printer, OS X says, ah, yep, I know where to get a driver for this. It pulls it down, or it just uses what it has on disk, depending on how you loaded it, and you're good to go. However, that's not always the best way to do it. Sometimes the best way is to get it from the manufacturer. And so I found a driver for the HP DeskJet 2510 on HP's site and sent Johnny a link, and it worked. But here's the thing. The HP 2510 was a typo on Johnny's part. He has an HP 2410. And therefore, when he searched for a printer driver, he couldn't find one because evidently, at least according to Johnny, HP doesn't have drivers for the 2410 available. But they have drivers for the 2510, and he tried it, and it worked. So there's a couple of lessons here, right? Number one is, pay attention to these crash logs, and you might be able to learn something. Sometimes they're not as verbose or as clear as this, but in this case it was, and it was helpful. And then the other one is, look for, you know, when you're searching for printer drivers, A, search online and go get the manufacturer's driver. Even if your driver, I was going to say even if your driver from Apple works, but then we're down the if it ain't broke, fix it till it is path. But sometimes you will get more functionality out of a manufacturer's driver. So there's that. And then, if you're having trouble, look for printers with model numbers that might be close. I know it's a little nuts to thank a typo for this solution here, but that's what we're doing. So these printers are all made, you know, when they're made by the same manufacturer, it could be, you know, the 2410 and the 2510. I honestly don't know the difference between the two, but it might just be a model year difference.
I have a title for the show.
What's the title for the show?
It's Better to Be Lucky Than Good.
It's better to be lucky than good. Yeah, well, that's it. But, you know, if you try one thing versus trying five things, the chances of you being lucky are multiplied by five.
There you go.
Yeah. Of course, your chances of being unlucky are also multiplied by five. So
five,
make a backup first.
Breaking it.
Right. Yeah, make a backup first. So, and Furby's in the chat room at MattGeekGab.com/stream is suggesting Gutenprint, which is yet another set of, I believe, and I might get this wrong, John, maybe you know more, open source-ish drivers for printers. So that's another option. We'll put a link to that in the show notes, too.
Yeah, good stuff. You know, I went through a similar thing with, so when I set up my parents with their iMac, they had a HP inkjet that, you know, eventually failed, just wasn't printing right. So got a new one, and for whatever silly reason, the Apple drivers, I don't know how this happened, it was weird to see, but the printer would only print in black and white. And it was a similar story. I was like, well, that's not right. And I'm like, well, you know what, instead of, because yeah, Apple, so what's supposed to happen is Apple or the printer vendors are supposed to or may choose to provide the computer makers, like, or the operating system makers like Microsoft or Apple, with drivers. But as you pointed out, they don't always provide the right ones or the latest ones. And I did the same thing. The only caution is that you got to be careful, because HP and others, you know, because I went to their site and they have, they're more than happy to volunteer to install all sorts of additional garbage besides the driver. So you have to be, you got to pay attention if you get it from the manufacturer, that what you're downloading, because it just got in the way. It was, you know, it was, you know, pictures, software, and, you know, all sorts of services they were offering. And it was just all this sort of garbage here. You had to be very careful when you ran the installer that you said, no, I just want to install the driver for this model printer. I don't want the other stuff, please. Because in my humble opinion, it'll cause you grief and just get in the way and cause problems down the road. Or at least that was my experience. So,
yeah, if you're right, you want the right driver for sure. Yeah. Yeah. It's interesting stuff. Fun though. You know, that's,
I don't know if that's my idea of fun.
Well, it makes for good stories after the fact.
You guys wouldn't have a show if they didn't do that stuff.
Well, there's that. Yeah. Yeah. But we wouldn't have a show if we didn't enjoy it at some level too.
There,
so
you go.
Yeah. Yeah. All right. Let's move on to, John. So, not you, John, of course, listener, John, Let's see. John writes, my 27-inch late 2012 iMac is at the Genius Bar waiting for a new hard drive, and over the last few days, I've seen some interesting things worth commenting on and have a few questions. First, when the problem arose, Carbon Copy Cloner reported errors reading files when doing the nightly clone. It seems like doing a regular backup might actually be a good thing for detecting problems early. Simultaneously, SoftRAID, which monitors all my attached hard drives, warned me of predicted drive failure on the internal hard drive, part of the Fusion drive. Having been alerted to the problem, I booted from the daily clone, but discovered it too had problems, such as the utilities folder being empty, yet Spotlight could find disk utility. Given that this wasn't part of the list of files Carbon Copy Cloner had problems reading, I don't understand why there were problems on the clone drive. I know you recommend checking backups, but this seems to be pot luck that I noticed something was missing, unfortunately, after a problem occurred. How do you recommend checking for this type of problem, and what might it be that occurred that gave the clone drive, given that the clone drive is showing no signs of failure? This is something I really want to get to the bottom of and try to avoid repeating in the future. I'm going to go on. He's got several questions here that we'll address, but it's an interesting thing. It says, despite the problems with the internal hard drive, Disk Utility reported it as being okay. Even the smart status in Disk Utility was okay, but using a utility like Smart Reporter, I could see zero reallocated sectors, but 530 offline pending sectors. Interestingly, up to the point today where the drive actually failed and became unreadable, reallocated sectors remained at zero, despite doing a zero across the drive and restoring from Time Machine. My other problem was restoring from Time Machine. I have this on my Drobo 5D, which I demoted to Time Machine function after setting up the Thunder Bay using SoftRAID. It says, despite having Thunderbolt, USB 3, and eSATA, Time Machine, when booted from the recovery partition, could not see my Time Machine volume. It turns out that Thunderbolt and USB 3 are not supported when booting into recovery and don't have eSATA. It seems ridiculous having to connect via USB 2 to restore, but that's what I did. It says, a final question relates to when I took the iMac to the Genius Bar. By that stage, the hard drive had failed. I'd like to think that I had pushed it over the edge by turning on File Vault to get the drive to work hard overnight. The diagnostics run by the Genius showed a red exclamation point for the failed drive. However, it also showed a yellow warning for RAM. I wondered if this is because I've added third-party RAM, but the Genius said it was because it was a non-standard RAM configuration. The machine came with 2x4 gigabyte chips, 8 gigs total, and I added 2 8 gig chips to it. There's 4 slots to give it 24 gigs. Seemed to work fine. My reply was that I was fully aware that in the past, RAM configuration had been very important, but that for this model, there was almost no guidance or requirement specifying what he had told me. All right, so let's talk about a few things here. We'll go in reverse order since that's how my brain's going to work today. For the RAM, I looked this up in Mac Tracker, and it says that that iMac, the iMac 13.2, assuming I'm getting it right, does support what's called memory interleaving. Assuming that's correct, and Mac Tracker is usually correct about these things, there is potentially some speed benefit. Maybe, I don't know, what do you think interleaving will give you, 5 to 10%, John?
That's about right. But okay. It's useful to point out that Apple typically lies about the amount of RAM. I don't know if they're doing it intentionally. You know, I don't know why they do it.
Yeah.
Why there's a discrepancy between the amount of RAM that they say.
Well, but they're not saying
can handle.
They're saying Apple says 32 gigs are capable in this machine. So what he's doing is well within Apple specs, and that's not what Apple's saying. Yeah, but you're right. Sometimes Apple's specs say that you can only do, you know, put 4 gig chips in a machine and 8 gig chips work totally fine. It's better to trust the RAM manufacturers than Apple on those types of things, I've found, especially like Crucial and OWC, the people that are, you know, reliable.
But the problem here is that he had 8 gigs and then 16 gigs.
He had 2 4 gig chips.
If he'd had 2 12s, they don't even make them, I'm sure. But had he had, you know, they want an even number, I guess.
Well, for interleaving, you do.
Yeah, right.
Right. Yeah. So he had 2 4s and then he added 2 8s. If he had done 4 8s or 4 4s, then the interleaving would have turned on in the machine and it can read and write to each bank separately, but it does them in sequence so that it goes faster. Right. Is what happens. Yeah. Interesting about USB 2. I don't know if that's a Drobo limitation or a limitation of the recovery partition. It doesn't neither of those makes sense to me. I can't imagine that the recovery partition, maybe it includes.
I understood it to mean the drivers just weren't there in that in that recovery mode to handle Thunderbolt.
Yeah, but why would it work with USB 2? I don't know. Yeah. But it is good to know. Yeah. I mean, if you're having trouble, and I'm not even sure how you would force it into USB 2 mode at that point. I mean, how would it? It's the cable, right?
Yeah,
I guess. I'm going to skip over one thing because I think it's. I'm going to skip over the smart stuff and come back to that last, just to get to this, the missing utilities folder. And your question, John, which is a good one, listener, John, about how to, we say it, you need to verify that your backups are, that the data is there. But the question is, how do you do that? And I can't think of any backup software that any of us use today that will do this. And it's a shame. I've tried. I don't think Carbon Copy Cloner does. I don't even think ProSoft's data backup does. Retrospect used to, and I guess if it still works, it would. But I don't. Time Machine definitely doesn't. And I don't know.
You're going to need a third-party utility like Delta Walker that will compare.
Yeah. I like it. I've never heard of Delta Walker, but it sounds good.
Yeah,
it
takes two drives or two folders even and compares them.
That's
and
right.
Shows, highlights the differences.
I'll put a link to it.
No, I think we got a heads up from the Carbon Copy Cloner guys. There is an option buried in Carbon Copy Cloner. I think it's this one here, find and replace corrupted files.
Oh, yeah, that's right.
Okay.
That's right.
We had this pointed out to us. I think it was by the Carbon Copy Cloner guys saying, oh, yeah. But the thing is, it obviously, or if it's not obvious, but it slows down your backup because it's doing a compare. So it's going to take way longer.
Yes.
But it gives you a warm fuzzy that what was backed up is matches, between the source and the destination. So,
That's, you know, again, I knew
I'll
was
double
there.
Check, but I
no,
think,
you're right.
Yeah, I'll double check, but I'm pretty sure that's the option you got to check. And it's not entirely obvious that, you know, checking that box means what it's going to do is verify your backup. I mean, they should have I personally think they should say, well,
verify.
Yeah. Verify.
Yeah, but you know, but the problem is like Time Machine, you can hold down the option key and go to the Time Machine menu and choose verify backup. But that doesn't verify the data. It just verifies the file structure. It just does a disk check on that, which is great.
It's doing
the
some
wrong
comparison.
Word. Yeah, no, it's not doing comparison. Any comparison. No. It is only doing a disk utility style verify disk versus repair disk on the disk image or the disk itself, but it's typically a disk image if you're doing it over the network. No, yeah, we've looked at it. It's only that. It's not. So it's a verify in the way that disk utility uses the word verify, but it's not a verify in the backup sense. So it's a little misleading, obviously. Yeah, it's not good. Yeah. Oh, good catch, John. I thought it was there, but you know, I started looking and I'm like, I guess it's not. So I'm glad you caught that. All right. So that's.
Yeah, I should actually enable it because I don't have it enabled for the backups that I currently do.
Right. Right. Yeah.
See I mean, I don't know if it doubles the backup time and then it does the backup and then it does the compare. Yeah. I'll have to see.
Mm-hmm.
I'll play with it.
Yeah. It is worth doing every now and then. I frankly think it's worth doing every time now that we're talking about. I mean, you know, I used to say to people, a backup that's not verified is not a backup. It's just a copy.
There you go.
You know,
it seems to me there's bound to be some scripting that would.
Yeah.
You could throw right in there.
Yeah. Yeah. Awesome. All right. Thanks, John. That's good. OK. And then on to the last thing with the disk, with other utilities reporting the disk as going bad, but disk utility saying nothing. As we've said in the past, smart is only a set of parameters that can be read from the drive. Smart in and of itself doesn't say, it's not black and white. It's not I'm bad, I'm good. It's not binary is a better way to say it, right? It's very much just here's all this data, interpret it as you wish. And disk utility is it takes a lot to sway disk utility into saying, yep, this drive is bad. Whereas Smart Reporter and SoftRAID look at things a little or interpret things a little bit differently. And like you saw, SoftRAID gave you a nice heads up that things were, you know, potentially going to go south. And it turns out it was right. So, yeah, disk utility is not the end all be all when it comes to interpreting smart data.
Oh,
right.
No.
Right, Mr. Brown?
No, of course not. Yeah, it's and these third parties, and you know, hats off to the third parties that write utilities that will look at the individual parameters, you know, and see important things like, you know, I mean, there's a whole pile of them, but there are certain ones that, you know, if you see them increasing, and I still don't know why the smart mechanism itself doesn't do that. I think they should upgrade it or something because, yeah, I mean, we've seen it or I've seen it on some of my drives. I had one that failed in my Synology once. It was an IO error. And when I looked at the smart parameters, there was one parameter. I think it was like failed, you know, read count or something or failed write count. I forget what it was, but sure. it was a value that was getting pretty huge. And I was like, well, why didn't Smart itself say, yeah, this is bad? And I, so.
Right. Yep. I agree. It's pretty crazy. All right. Moving on to Drew, who has a fantastic tip for us. In episode 584, we were talking about listener John and his iPad, where he couldn't get his iPad to back up to iTunes. And listener John wrote and said, I too have this issue. Only it's with multiple devices, my iPad, my iPad mini, my iPod, and my iPhone 6 using multiple USB ports and multiple cords. While troubleshooting, he says, I found an article on Apple's site about resetting the lockdown folder in iTunes. So there's this thing, and he says when he does it, and when he fixes this, it works for a little while. Or when he resets this folder, it works for a little while, and then it actually comes back. But there is this thing where, you know, when you plug your device into your Mac for the first time or a device into your Mac for the first time, your Mac and the device both ask you, hey, is it cool to talk to this, either to this device or to this computer? And that's to keep you from, it, you know, inadvertently putting some, you know, nefarious script on a USB device into your machine and having it wreak havoc on stuff. So you have to authenticate. And that's, I believe, that's what this lockdown folder is for. There is a way of resetting this lockdown folder, and it resets that whole trusted device thing. Thank you for the terminology, Brian Monroe. And you can reset this just by going in to this folder, which is vardb lockdown, and removing things. But there's a set of instructions that Apple provides for both OS X and various flavors of Windows. So you should be able to find it and reset this, and perhaps that'll fix that problem too. So thank you, Drew. Very good stuff. A lockdown folder, huh, John?
I have never heard of that. And yeah, look at that. There's even a Apple support article about it.
I remember it was a year or two ago, Allison Sheridan wrote from NozillaCast at podfeet.com, wrote us about it was this. I'm not sure if she called it the lockdown folder at the time, but there was something she was finding. It was just when this trusted device thing was starting, and she really dug in and found some of this stuff. So I'm glad that Apple has at least made it easier to find this stuff. So it's good.
Yeah, cool. Interesting. Mm-hmm. I have it on my mini, but the files in there are very old. They're dated 2011 and 2012. Huh.
Huh. Maybe you had, maybe it's been a long time.
Oh, wait. Well, yeah, typically I don't sync stuff to the mini. I would imagine it'd be newer on the, RDB.
Yeah.
Let's look on. Ah, there we go. Ah, okay. Yeah, I typically don't sync my devices with the Mini. I sync them with this machine. And ah, there we go. Yeah, they're all up to date. And they're owned by this mysterious user underscore USB MuxD.
Yeah. Well, that's right, right? Because it that process runs separately than root, again, to keep things from spinning out of control if there's a problem. All right, good stuff. Thank you, Drew. One last question before we move on to a couple of other things from listener Dave. Dave writes, let's see. He's having trouble with iOS mail. And I'm not going to read through his question because it was actually a series of about 60 emails that we went back and forth on this with. But what's happening is when Dave goes to archive mail in iOS, it doesn't put it in the archive folder that he has told iOS to use. It simply puts it in all mail, which is sort of like not doing anything. Every piece of mail that you have in Gmail is in all mail unless you move it to the trash. So something's not right. It's not keeping track of it. You can set this if you go into settings, mail, contacts, and calendars on your iPhone, and then go into whatever account it is, dig into the account again, and then go to the advanced menu. Here in the top section is mailbox behaviors, and you can set what you want your archive mailbox to be. And this can be anything that's exposed via IMAP. But no matter what Dave does, it doesn't work. Well, I think this is related to something we were talking about recently, which is that the caches in iOS mail can get stuck, like any caches can. The problem is when you delete a piece of, or when you delete an account from iOS, which is our typical advice for this, the cache is not deleted. So if you delete an account and then you bring that account back, it's going to inherit that cache again. Here's a piece of good news, though. Caches are not stored in backups. Okay. So if you back up your iOS device and then wipe it clean, and you have to wipe it clean, there are tools like one that we're going to talk about in our sponsor spot shortly, but tools like iMazing, which let you restore a backup without wiping first, which is really handy if you just want to change one little parameter. You change it in iMazing and it sends it back up, but it doesn't wipe out the caches because you're not wiping out the entire phone, and the backup, the caches aren't stored in the backup, so you can't erase them from the backup and then push an empty cache back up. It just doesn't work that way. So you have to wipe your phone, but then you can, this is the good news, restore from a backup, and the caches will be rebuilt. So that's the next step that I would do in the troubleshooting process on an iPhone, where especially where mail is getting weird. These caches are nutso. We've talked about them recently with, it remembering the mail server name and the login and not being happy about things. And this is all part of that. So wiping, the good news, and the folks at iMazing were quite helpful in helping me figure out that, yes, these particular caches are not stored in the backups, which makes sense. Caches shouldn't be stored in backups. So that's that. Interesting stuff, huh, John?
No, they could be stored in a backup.
They could. Thankfully, they're not, I guess. I mean, it's two different ways of solving the problem, but makes it easy, I guess. Takes a little time.
It's frustrating, though, because we've come across this issue more than once in that the relatively closed nature of iOS introduces these sort of problems.
That's right.
We need Onyx for iOS.
Yeah. Yeah. The problem is it can't. Apple doesn't allow. It could exist if you jailbreak your phone. But yeah, that's what we need is Onyx for iOS. Yeah. It's crazy. All right.
I'll ask him to start on that.
That's right. So now with that request out there, John, I would like to talk about our sponsors for today. That work for you?
Splendid.
All right. Well, I want to talk about iMazing at iMazing.com. This is a piece of software built to manage all of your iOS devices in ways that iTunes can't. And I say that, but in the last couple of weeks, I've actually been using this quite a bit. it does so much. You can back up your iPhone from iTunes. You can restore with iTunes. But when you do that in iTunes, it wipes out everything. Now, sometimes that's actually what you want. But a lot of times, all you want to do is restore a certain thing back. For example, I've been bouncing back and forth between my iPad Mini 2 and the review unit iPad Mini 4 that Apple sent me. Restoring everything, all my media and all that, takes forever. But with iMazing, I can take a backup from the iPad Mini 2 and just restore my new data back to the iPad Mini 4 much faster. Everything I want is there, all taken care of for me. My sister-in-law called me the other day and said, I got a new computer, but none of my songs are on it. They're only on my phone. How do I get them back to my computer? Well, my answer, iMazing. That's what it's built to do. Plug it in, pull the data back, and you're back in business. This is how it's supposed to work, folks. Any bit of data that you want to put in your backups, there it is. iMazing has it, and you can access it and selectively restore it back to your phone, even after making some edits in some cases. This is a piece of software that you really need if you've got an iOS device, an iPhone, an iPad. And as listener Douglas points out, I bought iMazing a while back, but what some may not know is that you can activate both the Mac and the Windows versions with the same key. What does this mean, you might ask? He asks in typical John Braun fashion. Well, it means you do not have to purchase two licenses to be able to use it on OS X at home and Windows at work. Gotta check this out. iMazing.com. It gets even better because coupon code MGG saves you 20% off the purchase price. Check it out. iMazing.com. Our thanks to DigiDNA, the makers of iMazing, for sponsoring this episode. Our sponsor, Squarespace, at squarespace.com/MGG, makes it really, really easy for you to build your own website and host it all from within your web browser. You don't need extra software. You don't need anything. All you need is squarespace.com/MGG. You go there, and then you just pick out a template, any template you like. They have tons of them. You kind of narrow down by choosing what you want to do with your site. Do you want to build a blog for yourself? You want to build a store? You just want to host your pictures? What do you want to do? And then you narrow down, pick a template that resonates with you, and you start putting your content in there. Whatever it is you want to do, it's super easy. I built a storefront for my band. We were having an event. We needed to sell tickets. Within an hour, I had the storefront created and published. I had the ability to take credit cards, and I didn't use any stuff that I've done before. They take care of all of that right inside the web form and development environment that they've built called Squarespace. It's truly amazing how easy it is to build and manage and just run your own website. The sites look professionally designed because they are. Your skill level doesn't matter. They've built the site. Your content magically fits into it. The tools are really easy to use. You're doing it inside a web browser. It's what you've always done. They have state-of-the-art hosting, so you don't need to worry about it. Your site's just always going to be up and running. Millions of people and some of the most respected brands in the world use it. Heck, I use it for my DaveTheNerd.com blog. Plans start at $8 a month. And if you sign up for a year, you get a free domain if you do that. Here's the thing. Coupon code MGG saves you 10% off of that $8 a month. So it really is inexpensive, totally easy. You got to check it out. Squarespace.com/MGG. Coupon code MGG saves you 10%. Squarespace, build it beautiful. Our thanks to Squarespace for sponsoring this episode. All right, John. We mentioned last week that we were going to talk about TiVo a little bit today. And now is the perfect time to do that. We've both been TiVo customers for almost two decades, right? I mean, I got TiVo when the first one had just come out and my daughter's 16. So we've had TiVo for almost 16 years now. And it's a wonderful thing. It's a great way to manage. If you have yet to cut the cord, TiVo is still, to me, the best way to manage certainly your cable TV, and can even do some of this stuff that your Apple TV can do as well, because it can connect to a lot of your online services, and Plex is one of them. So it can even see my movies on my disk station locally, in addition to Netflix and Hulu and Amazon Prime and all of that good stuff. So I've been checking out the new TiVo Bolt, which is their latest offering. And it's been an interesting thing, John. They've added some new features to this. So I'm coming from a TiVo Premiere, which is essentially two models old. I do not have a Romeo, which is what's essentially in between. Certainly timeline wise, the Romeo came out prior to the Bolt. Whether the Bolt replaces it in the lineup or not, it's a little, their lineup's a little bifurcated right now, because the 4K support is not in everything, and it's a little weird. But the Bolt's a cool little device, and it is a little device. It's much smaller than any previous TiVo I've owned, and it's a weird shape. It's kind of a wavy shape, which I assume is to discourage people from stacking things on top of it, which therefore is, you know, kind of a cooling thing. So, and it's white.
They let the design people have some fun, but because personally, my TiVo, I have my Blu-ray player and some other, and a switching adapter on top of it, and it handles it just fine.
I wonder if they put a different fan or something in this one, or no fan perhaps, or maybe don't want to run the fan all the time because in the living room that gets loud. I don't know. TVs run fans too, so I don't know. But it's you can't stack anything on it, and you notice it because it's white, unlike every other black component that I have. But it does some cool things, right? So first of all, it just in terms of using it compared to my Premiere, I would say it's a little faster. People that have gone from Premieres to Romeos, and even people that have gone from Premieres to Bolts, have said, oh, it's way faster. In navigating channels and stuff, I'm not finding that. But I didn't find the Premiere slow, so maybe I got lucky. We don't use Netflix, and I'm told that they moved from using Flash to navigate Netflix to using HTML5, so I can see where that would make things quite a bit faster with the Bolt and I believe the Romeo. But it does some cool things that I have not had access to in the past that were introduced with the Romeo, and then it does some cool things that were introduced just with the Bolt. So the things with the Bolt are quick mode and skip mode. And these are interesting things. You folks like chapters, right? Because that's part of what we do here with Mac Geek Cab. Well, skip mode is TiVo adding chapters to your TV programs. A lot of what this means is skipping commercials, but it's more than that. I've been using skip mode. It's not added to every show. It's only, I think, about 20 channels. It's TiVo personnel doing this manually. So they're watching the shows, right, and dropping anchors at the right spots. And I think it's only for shows between 4 p.m. and midnight or something. It's, you know, primetime-ish certain channels, but it's most of what, most of what you're going to watch is covered by this. So it's pretty cool. Okay. And it's cool because it records it. And then, you know, like an hour later, you see the little skip icon appear next to it in the thing. It like comes back in and gets it after the fact. One of the handiest things about it is being able to skip right to the beginning of the show. So you start playing and you're in like the, you know, whatever it is, the last show is ending, or you know, you're in some ad break or something, and you're like, no, I just want to get to the beginning of the show. You hit the green button on your TiVo, boom, right there at the beginning. You can jump segments too. So, you know, if I'm watching like Jimmy Fallon or something and he's got a guest on that I don't care about, or I, you know, only care about the musical guest and I want to get there, hitting the green button skips to the next segment. Very similar to what we do here with chapters. And so it works very, very well. I'm very impressed with that. And I hear, go ahead.
No, because prior models, I think the best you could do, and this was one of the things that made the TiVo and similar devices, though I'm not off the top of my head, I'm not aware of, you know, any, well, there are some cable companies that I guess make their own DVR, digital video recorder is what we'll call it here. But the best you could do, or at least with the TiVo that I have, and I'm pretty sure the prior ones, Dave, is you could basically fast forward through commercials.
Sure.
And then when they're over, you hit, you know, you stop fast forwarding, and then it's smart enough to bounce you back to where the And I think there was a trick. It was kind of a trick, but you could also skip in, I think, 30-second increments.
That's right.
If you hit a certain, and that kind of fits in with the, because most commercials are on a minute boundary, I think. So so that was the best that they could do in the past. But this is, I mean, this is pretty, it was funny when we were talking with them. I remember talking with them about it. And I'm like, so you really have people doing this? And it's like, yeah. And I guess, you know, it's something that technology just can't do yet.
Right. Yeah. Yeah, exactly. Well, it could. I bet it I have an app called CTiVo, which is an open source thing that allows me to do to pull recorded programs from my TiVo so I can save them off like on my disk station. And it makes use of another open source engine, if you want, called ComSkip, which will skip commercials automatically. And it does pretty well with it. I think it uses a combination of audio volume, you know, audio level differences and what do you call them? Subtitle differences, the closed captioning differences.
Sure. Oh.
And so there's some, it can get it wrong. But I've messed with it. It's okay. But you're right. It's not going to get it perfect and it's not going to get it every time. So TiVo's doing this as part of their, as part of the what you get with the service, and you get a year's worth of service with the TiVo Bolt when you buy it, which is interesting. Lifetime service is very expensive with it, though. It goes from $400 to $600, which is, they're very, it seems like they're trying to discourage people from getting lifetime service.
Oh, and it's not your lifetime either.
No, it's the lifetime of the Bolt. That's right. Yeah. Sometimes it extends to another Bolt if it's replaced in warranty.
Oh, gotcha.
Yeah. So,
and I think I'll upgrade at some point. So you had thought that I had upgraded. The thing is, every now and then, they'll send out an email because they have on file that I still have the Series 3 and they desperately want me to get off of it because they're actually taking features away. Like, for example, I think I mentioned this or if I didn't. But the thing is, you used to be able to go to the TiVo.com site and schedule shows or I used to be able to do that with my Series 3. Not anymore. You got to have at least a Premiere or a Romeo I think maybe a Romeo, but that they're starting to pull features out of the Series 3 because they just want you to get off of the thing.
Right. Right. Yeah. Well, that's the thing is they want you to upgrade. So they're discouraging you. You'd have to hold this for 5 years to make a lifetime subscription pay off.
I've gotten some deals from them saying, hey, we'll give you a refurb Romeo, basic Romeo. And they call it something else now. They don't call it lifetime anymore.
Right,
All something. I forget. But I've actually seen where they're like, hey, if you want a refurb and lifetime service, $300.
Yeah, but
I
that's
almost
just,
went for it. I actually should have.
Well, that's the Romeo S, right? That's the very
entry-level Romeo.
Which skips a lot of the features that make it a Romeo, and I'll get to those, because it's important to pay attention to this stuff, because you may not get what you want if you do that. Let me finish with the new Bolt stuff, and then I do want to come back around to that. Quick Mode is, it's an interesting concept. So the idea is behind Quick Mode is you turn it on, and it plays your show 30% faster. Obviously, only works with recorded stuff. It's not going to play live stuff 30% faster because it's not magic. But we've tried it. There are some things for which it works just fine. Talk shows. I know a lot of people listen to this podcast at about 30% faster. And no problem, right? It works for you. It's great. Talk shows, it works okay for. Some sporting events, it works okay for. And some shows, it just doesn't work well at all for. But in all cases, what they're doing is speeding up the video and they're speeding up the pace of the audio, but not the pitch. So it keeps everybody from sounding like their album in the Chipmunks. Everybody's voice stays where it needs to be. And yet it just goes faster. You lose 5.1 sound when you're doing that. It mixes it down to 2-channel sound when you're in quick mode. But, for watching stuff, it takes your brain a minute or two to adjust. At first, it's this very stressful kind of thing, you know.
Like Kaiser Wilhelm walking around.
Yeah, exactly. But then you're okay. Then, you know, again, depending on the show, you might like it and you might not. But it's definitely an interesting thing. I believe skip mode, actually, I believe, is what's coming to the Romeos, at least the two Romeos that are left. The Romeo S that you were talking about is decommissioned, right? And the Bolt effectively replaces that in the lineup. But skip mode's coming to that. Streaming is something interesting. Now, with the Bolt, you can stream to devices in your house. And this is where TiVo, it's clear where TiVo is going with this. Right now, I have three TiVos in my house, three completely separate TiVos. We'll take the Bolt out of it because that's just a review unit. But I have three TiVos, each with two tuners. They can bounce shows between them, and that works just fine. But they can also all record stuff. But that means they also each need a subscription and all of that. I've got them all on Lifetimes, and I actually paid, I think I only paid like $199 for each one. So they've paid off the Lifetime thing. But TiVo doesn't want you to do that. They want you to have one box in the house and then stream to all the other TVs or all the other screens in your house. And so what the Bolt lets you do is you can stream inside the house to your iPad or iPhone, which is handy, or you can stream to other TVs if you put a TiVo Mini on those TVs. And I think the Mini is about $150, but there's no subscription with the Mini. You buy it, you put it on the TV, and you're done. And now you've got this Bolt, which has four tuners in it, or a Romeo, but not the entry level Romeo. And it will do streaming inside the house to all your devices. And you have one place where all your shows are recorded. And then from there it streams, and it'll stream live TV or it'll stream whatever you've recorded. And it's a very fluid kind of thing. So this is very cool. Now that's what the Romeos, again, not the entry level Romeo, but the you know, the two that are left in the lineup, I think the Pro and the Plus. I have to look, I'm making that up, or I'm recalling it from a very dim memory, but, the Romeo, so that's the TiVo Bolt will only stream locally in the house. The Romeos will let you stream locally and remotely. They say that remote streaming is coming to the Bolt in a software update later this year. So we'll have to keep an eye on that. So it's, but that streaming thing is pretty cool. You know, and I can see where, you know, you might start doing some interesting stuff where, you know, you just, again, you just have the one box. And if you are not a cord cutter, a TiVo really can be the right, if you only want one box and you're not a cord cutter, a TiVo can be the right thing because you're getting your broadcast stuff. It'll let you stream. And TiVo was the first, we talked about it on the show almost a year ago. TiVo were the first ones to get universal search right. If I get what they call a one pass, it used to be a season pass for a show, John. I don't just get a season pass for recorded versions of the show. I can go and navigate the entire history of the show. And any service to which I subscribe, that could be Amazon Prime, it could be Hulu, it could be my cable company's on demand or recorded stuff, all is seen as one. And they really do it well. It's almost seamless. You just say, I want to watch this episode. And it says, okay, here's the four sources for it. Two of them are pay, two of them are free. Which one do you want? So it's cool stuff, John.
That's brilliant.
Mm-hmm.
Nice. Now you have, the thing is I only have one, so I don't do the you know, streaming to locations. Now I gather you have these are all, hooked up wirelessly or do you have it, wired?
I believe all of my TiVos are wired. The Bolt actually has an 802.11 AC chip in it, so it'll connect wirelessly.
Oh,
yep.
Right.
But I do them all wired, I don't know. I mean, I could do it differently. I just choose. I have Powerline running everywhere. Powerline is showing its age, though. It's not getting fast enough to match all the speeds that we're getting. And I've got some things to talk about in Cool Stuff Found later about making that faster. But so they can be okay. Wired or wireless. Yeah.
Could that be my one concern? Is, you know, streaming video requires, you know, a certain size pipe and,
yeah,
Not everyone may have that. I even upgraded mine. So they, so of course the newer ones have the wireless built in. I actually for mine bought, they have, I did have an 802.11g adapter. That mm-hmm. was one option they offered. And then they offered, but then I upgraded to 802.11n, which of course is faster if you don't know that.
Right.
And that it actually, it's kind of a hack. It actually, it's actually a little access point, if you will, but it plugs into the Ethernet port on the older models. So yeah, that was another reason that, you know, I wanted to consider upgrading, because you don't need a third party or an external adapter. The networking's all built in already.
Yeah.
Or, you know, like you said, if you got a power line or, hardwire connection, that's good too. But yeah. Okay, so streaming to other rooms,
we have been doing it actually backwards, because we had all of our shows were being recorded to our TiVo Premiere, which I moved out of the living room temporarily, and I moved it up to the bedroom. And so we copied some shows over. And you can go online and migrate all your season passes from your old device to your new device, or some of your season passes between devices. And TiVo makes it really easy. But we copied some shows over, but then I realized, wait, we don't have to. You can just navigate over the network. That used to be kind of a disaster with TiVo. Now I forget that I'm navigating over the network, and I just hit play and it works. And yeah, obviously my network is fast enough so that I don't notice any lagging, but beyond that, it's brilliant. It's great. So we're still watching shows that our old device recorded before we set the new one up. It's cool.
Now, what are they? And the one thing that we relied on third parties here. I don't know if they've changed this though. But to either upload content to the TiVo, which sometimes you may want to do, upload your own content, or downloading it from the TiVo. Now, have they made any advances as far as you being able to either pull content from it or put content on it, or you still have to rely on things like PyTiVo and CTiVo and, all
that? Yeah. The third party stuff is the way to go with it, but it works really well. I mean, CTiVo is fantastic. We'll put a link in the show notes about it, but it's killer. I still use it all the time. Yeah. It's good.
Okay, and the storage in that thing is
500 is gigs or a terabyte.
Okay,
and you can,
it's a rotational.
Yes, it's rotational. Drive. Correct, and you can, as with most TiVos, I think even yours support an eSATA device out the back, and has to be TiVo certified eSATA. And I believe Western Digital is the only company that sells one. But
right,
you can do it. Or Weaknees offers, internal hard drive upgrades, or you can do them yourself to get to 3 terabytes or something, whatever you want to do. Yeah. It's fun stuff. And it really, again, if you're cutting the cord, TiVo's not the right thing for you. Although it's getting closer to being the right thing even for that. But certainly if you haven't cut the cord and you don't intend to anytime soon, TiVo's the way to go. It's a very Apple like experience. And like I said, they get, to this day, they still have the best universal search I've ever used. So highly recommend to check it out. Again, the decision between the Bolt and the Romeo, either the Pro or the Plus, is not an easy one to make. You kind of got to look at the features and whether you want 4K and all of that stuff. But the Romeos have 6 tuners, whereas the Bolt has 4. 4 and 6. I mean, that's a lot of tuners to record simultaneously. But if you're doing this in-house streaming thing where you only have one device, well, now maybe, you're going to use more tuners simultaneously. Maybe. It depends on how many people you got in your house and how crazy you are. Yeah.
Now, have you entertained, because I think even the model that I have, if I wanted to hook up an antenna, I could.
Yes.
As a source. Yes. Have you dabbled with that at all? I think some of our colleagues have done that.
I haven't, but you can. Yeah, that's right. It's interesting.
I haven't even tried in this area with an antenna since we've gone all digital.
Yeah.
Have you?
Ever? No.
No, yeah.
No, I don't. Like, yeah. I get enough trouble with lightning here at my house, yeah. Pete.
You need to stick a piece of metal up in the air and see what happens.
Let's see what happens. Yeah, exactly.
What could go wrong?
Yeah. All right. So let's, any other questions on that, John, before we, move on?
No, I'll have to, consider my path forward here.
Me too. Cause this device has to go back and I'm, you know, I'm kind of liking this whole streaming thing and, the skip mode thing. So it's going to be tough to get to pry it out of my fingers, but I'll, you know, I honor my commitments, all that, send it back. but I'm going to play with it for a little while longer. I've got it at least, I think, through the month of January. So if you folks have questions, you know, feel free to ask. I've got it here for a little while. So until I buy one to replace the one that I got to send back. So, all right. I'm looking at a couple of things here. Leslie, on Facebook, actually, asked us a great question. It was very interesting. This is a mess. I put a Facebook PDF in the thing. I think I can read it. Leslie says, I'm having a strange problem. The icons on my desktop have vanished. I rebooted and the icons were gone. I went to the dock and clicked on the Finder to open up a window. The desktop folder is still there and the aliases are all there along with all my JPEGs and everything that I had always had on my desktop. I went to Finder, Preferences, General to see if Show These Items on Desktop has been altered, and it hasn't. I unchecked all the items, rebooted, checked all the items, rebooted again, still no icons. Normally, if I click the desktop, the Finder menu appears beside the black apple with all of the menu options. It no longer does that. I had to open a window to get to the Finder options. I'm fearful of something drastic might have happened to the core of my MacBook Air. Please help. And then Leslie actually solved his own problem here, which he also posted again. And this is all in our Facebook group at MacGeekHub.com/Facebook. Great stuff. But there was a good path that happened, and he found a terminal command called create desktop, or the terminal option, which was defaults, write com.apple.finder, create desktop, and then set that to true, and that turned it back on. He thinks that using Pathfinder might have turned this off. I believe that's what he said, but something turned it off, and so you can turn the desktop on and off. My guess is that Onyx would have had this in its options as well, but that's a great solution. So thank you, Leslie, for asking and then also answering your own question, but good stuff.
And you read my mind, my friend, because I am looking right now at Onyx, and I suspect what may have happened is, and you know, we love these things, but sometimes they get screwed up. A cache file. And specifically, I'm looking here. So in Onyx, our favorite, well, one of our favorite utilities, because it gives you the potential to just ruin everything, but right. Also fix things.
Right.
But if you go to cleaning user, I see a couple of categories, Dave, that I think are suspect. So one is desktop background. Another is dock icons, and another is icon services. So there's a number of things. There's at least three caches that I see that, if they get corrupt, could have caused this. So I, as you suspected, I think using Onyx to clean that stuff up may have also repaired this, or at least rebuilt
right
what got clobbered.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, yeah. Cool. All right. I want to get to cool stuff found, John. You ready? I've been playing with this new wireless presenter for $13 on Amazon from Inatech. You can get this. It's a little, thing that you would use for doing like keynote presentations, right? And what's cool about it is it runs off of a AA battery that you put inside it. It has its own, like a lot of wireless remotes do, it has its own little dongle that you just plug into your USB port, but the dongle lives inside the remote with a little magnet latch. The remote is a little thicker than a pencil, but that's about the size of it. It's very thin, easy to fit in your laptop bag or whatever, and just leave it there. You can leave another AA battery in there for when it dies, which of course would happen eventually. It's got a laser pointer in it and works great with Keynote. And $13, you know, you don't have to spend a fortune to have something that you can just leave in your bag and use. You could even get two of them if you've got, you know, a couple of different places you do presentations. I've been wanting one of these for a while, but I don't do it often enough where I feel like, you know, I should go spend $100 on, you know, some state of the art, whatever. This thing works great. So $13. I like it. It's a good deal. Where are we next, John, here? I guess listener John, huh? Pie hole. Yeah, that's right. He says, I just listened to the...
Shut your pie hole.
As in shut your... That's right. I just listened to the last show and had a comment about the caller who had a question about blocking ads and trackers. If you have a Raspberry Pi, check out Piehole at piehole.net or pi-hole.net. You set it up as your home network's DNS server, and it automatically drops all ad-related traffic locally, thus speeding up your internet access a lot. It's pretty simple to install, and a developer is constantly updating it. I'll leave the political discussion about ad blockers and all of that out of it, but I love stuff like this, and I love the open source community and all of it. So, John, do you have a Raspberry Pi yet? And if so, wow, why not?
Maybe I should. I'd have to think of a project to do.
Oh, no. See, I think it's just the opposite. Just get a Raspberry Pi and start doing projects. I think it would be like you know, a kid in a candy store for you, the way you like to tinker with hardware. And this, like, blends it all together in an easy way. And I don't know. And yeah. Cheap.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I've done embedded stuff in my day.
That's what I mean. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. All right. Let's see. Moving on. I think we got time to blow through some of these. Marco says, I recently got a refurb 2012 Mac Mini. I did a fresh install of El Capitan and transferred files over from my old iMac. Let's see. Oh, never mind. I think we talked about that. He says, cool stuff found. Stands for Macs. 3 to choose from. It's called Monitor Mate. For those who don't need the fanciness of a Thunderbolt dock, maybe this might work. And it is. It's at monitormate.com.tw. We'll put a link in there. It's a little monitor stand or an iMac stand, right? It could go either way, but it's USB 3 and it's got USB 3 ports on the front, USB 2 ports on it. It's got a micro SD. It's got a card slot that'll support SDMMC, compact flash, micro SD. And it's like a little stand. I'm trying to think of the right shape for it. It looks like kind of like a toboggan that you put upside down, I guess.
Yeah, or a shelf.
Right, or a shelf.
Well, it's a shelf.
Yeah, a shelf is the right term. Yeah, so you could slide your keyboard underneath this thing. And, you know, much cheaper than a Thunderbolt dock if that's not what you need. So, thank you. I love this stuff. It's cool. Makes me kind of want to get one for my desk. I don't know. Put all kinds of stuff there. Anyway, that's where we're at.
You need more stuff on your desk.
Yeah. <She's> telling me.
There's that.
Yeah, that's the problem. Moving on to... Any thoughts on that, John, before we move on to Greg?
No, I should look at that. Because right now, my monitor elevation technology is a thick book.
A thick book. Yeah. Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
On my desk here.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. The only thing I don't like about the new screen I got, I think I showed it to you at one point here, but the Asus wasn't adjustable height wise. The one I had before was. So that's the only thing I don't like about it.
Yep.
Otherwise, I mean, the image quality is awesome.
That's awesome. That's awesome. All right. Let's, you know what? Let's let Max take a turn and tell us a little something.
Hey, John Dave, this is Max. I was calling in with a little cool stuff found really quickly. I just found this out recently. It's probably been mentioned on the show before, but I have an old Power Macintosh running 10.4 Tiger, and I'm about to upgrade it to 10.5, but I realized that Onyx something that you've mentioned in the past can do a lot of more different things. Like, for example, on at least on the Tiger version, it can make you can turn your Mac so it will always boot in verbose mode, or that you can set like one of your screensavers as your live desktop. Now, it does give you a warning for your live desktop saying you should have a lot of processor power, but it still works on my old G4, so thought I would just send that in, and you can cut me off here.
Thanks, Max. That's great, man. Awesome stuff. You know, and that's the thing is Onyx has so much to it, which is why they built that maintenance utility, right? Because if you just want to do the maintenance stuff, it's nice to have just everything else kind of carved away. But yeah, Onyx is, it's fun. Thanks for the reminder to dig deep. It's good.
I'm impressed that Max is kicking it old school there.
I know.
On the both the hardware and the operating system. And it's worth noting that Onyx, you need to get, there's a version of Onyx specific to each major release of Apple's operating system. And you want to be sure that you... you know, I think, Dave, one time I tried to run an older version of Onyx after I had upgraded the OS, and it didn't warn me.
Yeah.
I was kind of expecting it to do that. And then I had the Yosemite version, and once I upgraded to El Capitan on my Mini, I remember I don't often need to run it on the Mini. I distinctly recall trying to run the older version and it ran, and I'm like, oh, that's not good.
That's not good. Yeah.
Well, no, because I mean, they get real intimate with the depths of OS 10, and I'm just afraid that, you know, if you run a version that's not appropriate for your OS, you may destroy everything.
Yeah, that's right. I like that it will run, because it's good that it would, you know, if there's something if you just updated and there's something you need to do, and you know that whatever the way it's going to do it is safe, or you're willing to take the risk, it's nice to have it before they get whatever their update is. But yeah, I agree. It should warn you. I'm into that. All right. A quick one from, as all the cool stuff found items are, from Fran, saying this: if you pay your cellular phone bill with a credit card, you might get some insurance benefits for your phone that are as good as or better than AppleCare, saving you the monthly charges for the latter. And Fran sent us a link to a Magnify Money article that talks about a lot of these different things. The only what I'll call major bank that's represented here is Wells Fargo. But if you're simply paying your cell phone bill with your credit card, every phone that you have is covered for up to $600 per incident. You can get 2 incidents per year, and they have a $25 deductible. So this is way better than AppleCare in most cases. I realize there's some phones that cost more than $600 to replace brand new, but a lot of times when you go to Apple, as we found, you're paying the $300 or whatever, the flat rate repair minus your $25 fee. So check this list out, and also just check with your bank, your card issuer, because you might be getting something without even realizing it. So that's good stuff.
They don't advertise that, do they? Hey, we'll pay for your phone.
Yeah, right.
No, they certainly do. Though sometimes when you get the agreement with your card, I mean, you know, some of them are pretty formidable. I don't necessarily look through them, but I have an Amex, like I think you guys do. But,
yeah.
I'm pretty sure Amex offers some level. I'm pretty sure the card that I have has a thing that'll double the warranty.
That's right.
On things as well. And actually I got this the other day, which is kind of neat. I got a Citi card, and they actually have a rewind or a price, like a price search feature.
Yep.
They're like, hey, if you buy something with the card and you find it for less somewhere else, we'll give you a refund.
Yeah.
It's like, oh, that's, thank you.
Yeah. Yeah. Price protection or whatever. Yeah. It's good. Yeah. It's a good reminder to check out your cell phone, you know, extended warranties or damage protection, because these things do exist. And then price protection, you get them, not necessarily with every card, but frankly, most cards probably have them. So check it out. It's worth it. Thank you, Fran. Excellent, excellent stuff. Brian tells us about an Apple Knowledge Base article. He says, I recently dealt with one of those pop-ups that say your Mac is infected and ask you to call a number to get it fixed, like you did, John. In researching how to deal with the issue, I came across a support article from Apple that might be worth sharing. And indeed, we'll put it in the thing. It's a Stop Pop-Up Ads and Adware in Safari that kind of walks you through some steps that you can go through, and including looking in specific folders on your Mac for things to uninstall. Safari extensions. I had somebody that was telling me, oh, every time I visit, you know, your website, it was actually a different project I was working on. It wasn't TMO. But every time they visited, they would get this thing that came up, and it was like, you know, Shopify or I don't know, something. And it was like, well, okay, but we don't, you know, we're not running any JavaScript on this thing. It was nothing. It wasn't an ad supported site. It was just actually an internal thing that nobody in the world even knows about, let alone has access to. And sure enough, I said, well, you go to your extensions. I don't know. And they're like, well, yeah, here's this, whatever it was, you know, Shopee Mate or something. I'm like, well, yeah, remove that. If it's there, of course, it's going to be on every website you visit. But it's hard to, you know, and this person didn't know how they got it installed or anything. So we removed it and everything was fine. Apple keeps this article up to date with all kinds of things, folders you should look at, things you should delete, processes. I'm not going to go through them all, but it's great. Definitely worth checking out. You know, because you don't want to have adware. I looked at all of it. I didn't have anything, but it's worth taking, you know, whatever it is, 5 minutes. So thank you, Brian. Good stuff. Did you look through that yet, John? Yeah.
I'm almost certain that we've linked to that article or one similar from Apple. And yeah, they dig pretty deep. They're like, you know, where to go to fix things. The only thing I'd recommend is that there's a dandy piece of software that does, I think most, I think the article goes into a bit more detail, but there's a dandy piece of software called Malwarebytes Anti-Malware for Mac that I run on occasion to look for this stuff. And actually, my mom or my parents set up their iMac. They were having some weird behavior. And I was like, that's not right. So I actually ran this tool and it found adware. She they had gone to a site and, you know, it was, I think, one of these bogus, you know, flash installers or something like that. And, you know, it's hard, though, because I was trying to explain, you know, well, you know, if it's coming from here or coming from there, you may not want to install it. And you know, it's hard to tell. And I think she also had Mac Keeper installed. And I'm like, oh, boy. Well, because, you know, I think she was bamboozled because, you know, they're some of the stuff they put on some pages tends to look like it's part of the page and something you should install.
Absolutely.
You know, like recommended. So that's a good tool as well.
Yeah. Cool. Hey, John, have you ever heard of DECA, DECA adapters? We've talked about Mocha and we've talked about Powerline, and DECA is similar to Mocha. So Powerline runs Ethernet over your power lines simultaneous with your power. And we mentioned it earlier in the show. It's what I'm using at home. I'm a big fan of it, but, you know, the most I can get even out of the newer, you know, 2 gigabit ones, which are essentially just Powerline MIMO, so it's dual band running simultaneously, is maybe 120 megabits, right? You know, so it's not terrible, but it's not great. Mocha, I have not tried, but I want to. I've heard that can be faster. Mocha does the same thing, sends Ethernet over your coax cables alongside of your coax. But some people say their, you know, their speeds aren't that much better with it. Well, DECA, DECA, is over your cables, your coax cables, and goes much faster because it uses the whole thing. And that's the caveat, is you cannot be sending TV over these cables. But a lot of us in our homes have cable runs that are unused. And if you've got, you know, cable in the walls, even if it goes, even if their home runs down to a, you know, a, what would be a hub or a splitter, if you take the two things off, the two off the splitter and join them together and just have them run, you can use these DECA adapters. I mean, I think they're less than $10 a piece. And so, you know, you get a DECA adapter on either end, and now you're doing, you know, 100 megabits per second in both directions simultaneously. So, yeah, it can be, you know, another option, not necessarily for everybody, but, you know, older homes and that sort of thing where the power lines are, you know, questionable. This can be a good option. So it's interesting stuff, John. I'd never heard about it before, but somebody was telling me about it. It's obviously been around for a while. So
I hadn't either.
Yep.
And, oh yeah, look at that. Searching for DECA, the cheap alternative to Moka.
Yep. Okay. Yeah. That's pretty cool. Cheap and, you know, probably well worth it. If you've got out, you know, coax in the right spots. And we're, you know, everything we're talking about, DECA, power line, Moka, it's all, you know, filed under the category of, I wish I did, but because I don't have Cat 5 in my walls. And honestly, I think the next time I have an electrician out to the house, John, I'm going to just have him run a Cat 5 down into my living room or up into my living room, depending on how I want to do it, because it would make my life so much better. You know, the power line isn't quite enough to get things either in one direction or the other, the way I want to do it now. It used to be. It's very reliable, so that there's that, but it's, you know, it's not quite fast enough. I mean, I'm getting 180 megabits per second out of my cable company now downstream, and power line's not enough to keep up with that. And also just beaming stuff around the house, like you said, you know, you want to send HD content to your TV or from your TV, it's, you need bandwidth. What I am messing with, and this show, you're still there, right, John?
Yes, sir.
Good. So I'm running DDWRT, my favorite firmware, on that new Netgear R8500 router, the tri-band router. And what I'm, but it's like the first build, the first experimental build of DDWRT for this router. So I absolutely shouldn't be doing this while we're doing a show, but I am. And my family's kind of mad at me because they say that we used to have like the best Wi-Fi in the state of New Hampshire in our house. And lately it's been a little less than reliable. Because of my muddling, but, be that as it may, it has 2 5 gigahertz radios in it and 1 2.4. So what I'm thinking of doing is using one of the 5 gigahertz radios, and I've tested this and it gets enough bandwidth. I can get about 300, maybe even 400 megabits per second, 802.11ac signal between where the router is kind of upstairs and the living room downstairs, as a backhaul. Right. So using instead of using power line, just using that Wi-Fi signal, but not sharing it with anything else, just using it as the backhaul between the two. And then I've got my TV down there and it's, you know, all happy and everything. So essentially just having it act as the client, not doing a repeater thing. Or if I do a repeater, repeat it on 2.4 gigahertz to spread that signal around. But essentially using, you know, 802.11ac as my, you know, backhaul for that. So that's, you know, it's on the list, but I gotta go easy because my family's, they're not happy with me. So
they broke, fix it till it is.
Well, that's a little bit about what's going on here. So
I'll tell them to deal with it or use SneakerNet.
No, what they use is they start just using their LTE connections on their phones and they know how to
go through the roof.
Correct. Yeah, exactly. So, hey, here's a thing, a free tip, right? So, well, they're all free, but I'm an AT&T customer, right? And I wanted to, we're going to Mexico. Lisa and I are going to Mexico to see fish at in Playa del Carmen or Riviera Maya or something later in January. A couple of weeks ago, I noticed that AT&T just opened up their family share plans. Their new family share plans allow calling not just to Mexico, but from Mexico for free. And you get a gig of data per month per device in Mexico. And that was the only difference between these plans. And prices are the same and everything was like just a new promotion or whatever. So I thought, well, I'll move over to it. So do that, right? That's part one of the tip is just if you're an AT&T customer, do that. But time it well. Our cell phone bill, we get 15 gigs a month and we have rollover data. Now, when you change plans, you lose the data only rolls over 1 month anyway. It only carries forward a month. So the most I could have in any given month is another 15 gigs if we had used nothing. Yeah. However, you lose your whatever you have has rolled over when you change plans. And so I was like, well, I better do this quickly because I did it and I timed it so that our plan rolls over on the 8th of the month. I think I changed to this on like the 6th of December. I'm like, so it doesn't really matter. I'm going to lose stuff anyway. I'll be fine. We're not traveling a bunch in December anyway. It'll be fine. We never use our 15 gigs anyway. Well, I changed plans on the 6th of December and I lost my rollover data and my data for that month, the month that ended on December 7th, reset to zero. So I rolled almost 15 gigs into December because maybe we used a gig in that day or something, but you know, so we started December with like 29 gigs of data for the family that we aren't going to use. So.
Yeah, but you could roll into January now.
We'll roll what's left of December's into January. That's right. Yeah. So it's fun. There you go. So there's the AT&T family share tip. I don't know. It's crazy. You're still Verizon, right, John? You're happy with them. They keep giving you extra data, right?
Yeah, and I'm looking, and it's funny because I got the baby plan that only had 1 gig of data, but I'm looking at my phone here and the widget that I have still says I have 2 gigs. Wow, maybe they just upped everybody from 1 to 2.
Awesome.
That's nice.
I think they did that. Yeah, I think they update. I think a lot of times the cell companies will do these things and they'll say it's a short term experiment, especially the big ones, right? Like AT&T and Verizon, because they've got to compete with T-Mobile, which is also a big one, but it's kind of the scrappy one. And Sprint's also kind of scrappy and they've got to compete with them. So they offer these, they roll these things out. They're like, it's just a test and yada, yada. And then it just stays forever. Like our plan, I said it's a 15 gig plan. Well, that was because we signed up for it. It's a 10 gig plan where you got 50% data for free. But they said, if you sign up, you keep it forever. Well, even new plans have that. But it's their way of rolling it out and testing it and saying, are we going to lose our shirts? No. Our customers staying? Yes. Awesome. Good. We'll keep it. That's how it works. Feedback at MattGeekGab.com is where you can send in cool stuff found, questions, tips, whatever you want. Crash logs. We love it. Good stuff.
Yeah. I don't know about that. I much prefer feedback. At MackieGap.com.
I'm hungry. Let's get the feedback at... Oh, feedback. I'm sorry, guys. Food. Feedback at MackieGap.com.
Or premium at MackieGap.com. For those of you that are premium members and support us directly, you don't have to. It is certainly appreciated. It is more than appreciated. We are truly humbled by all of you that support us. And if you're interested in it, visit MackieGap.com for more details. We'd certainly appreciate it. And as part of that appreciation, anything sent to premium at MattGeekGab.com is prioritized, and that's the box we tend to answer first for you. 206-666-GEEK is the number anyone can call and leave a message for us. And John, Geek is?
4-3-3-5.
We're still looking for iTunes comments, folks. I'd love to see more iTunes comments. So just take a minute out of your day. Go review Mac Geek Gab in iTunes. We will love you for it. We love you anyway. We'll love you a little bit more for that. Please do it. We'd love to see it. It's great stuff. It helps us all. Cashfly, CACHEFLY.com. Provides all the bandwidth to get the show from us to you. Our thanks go out to them as always. Our thanks also go to our sponsors. As we mentioned in the show, iMazing with coupon code MGG saves you 20%. Squarespace with coupon code MGG saves you 10%. Gazelle at gazelle.com, where you can sell off the old iPhone that is now replaced by the new one that you got for whatever holiday you celebrated in the last month here. Smile at smilesoftware.com/geek, where they always talk about the latest stuff from us to you. Linda at lynda.com/mgg, where you get 10 free days of their great videos. Otherworld Computing at maxsales.com, one of my favorite vendors for RAM and hard drives and SSDs and fun stuff. And of course, Barebone Software at barebones.com, makers of BB Edit. You got to check it out. Pete, we've got an interesting holiday coming up here. I would like to make sure everyone celebrates their way into the new year safely, because we want you all to stick around, but of course have fun. Pete, do you have any advice to share?
Drink and drive. Well, there's that.
There is that. That's actually really good advice.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So be careful with that. And I won't even be flip about that one and say don't. You know what I'm about to say.
Right.
You know, just don't do that.
Yeah. Yes.
And then anything else you do while you're out there having fun, if you think someone's watching, that's fine. But don't get caught.
Made up.